There's Bible verse I think about sometimes. Many times. It goes. And I heard the voice of the Lord, saying, "Whom shall I send? Whom shall I send? And who will go for us? Go for us." Ideas like virus.
Final installment on John here, classmates. I hope you enjoyed what I had thus far. Amazing character study on someone I wasn't as familiar as I should be, so I'm glad I dug in on him. I was not disappointed. Hopefully you've gotten something out of this that you hadn't known before. That's always my goal. The final story and the text we have on John the Baptist are not the warmest and snuggliest, sadly. I spoiled what happens a bit earlier in the series, but don't worry, there's still some meat on the bone. And with that, let's get into it. Quoting Matthew 11 here to set the table, after Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in the towns of Galilee. Now when John, the baptizer, was in prison, he heard about the deeds of the Messiah, and see, he sent his disciples to ask Jesus, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we be expecting someone else?" End quote. All right, so we are in the thick of Jesus' work on earth here. He's been going around town to town, teaching, healing, performing signs and wonders, announcing the kingdom of the skies is here, showing them what it's going to look like from here on out. Right before the quote in chapter 11 here, we just had in chapter 10, Jesus working through his disciples to spread his message and take it out to the lands. He equips the 12 disciples, which, you know, number 12 is a clear callback to the 12 sons of Jacob. Hopefully you see that by now. And sends them out. And they do what Jesus has been teaching them to do and asks them to do the same. Pretty relevant to our current calling as disciples now. Remember, Jesus wants disciples, not just believers. Believing and receiving this gift is step one, but we got work to do. I have found that working his teachings into my everyday life is both incredibly simple and yet remarkably difficult. But I think that daily internal war with my own selfish wants and needs and the disciplines of discipleship will continue until my time on this earth is up. And that's a beautiful thing. But let's check back on the location of where John is when he asked this question. Might help us out a little bit. He's not at the ancient Roman bathhouses surrounded by tiles and sunshine and women. He's in prison. And he is periodically visited by his own disciples and getting reports through note passing on how it's going out there in the empire and, you know, what's happening with his renewal of hearts movement thing that we're called to do. King Herod didn't love the way people were responding to this crazy man wearing camel hair and eating bugs, so he decided to give him a little time out. Time to think about if you want to keep this holy war against Rome thing going and see if he can get John to question some things. And even bold, you know, heaven-touched John had some doubts, you know? This doesn't look like it did in his mind where he started. Keep in mind, this is a Roman prison. This is not a holiday. They barely get food and water or sunshine. They're beaten on for fun by the guards who are bored, and if you don't have friends bringing you food, bread, morsels, they would happily watch you starve and make bets on it. So he gets these reports on Jesus and wants to send a message back to him. Now, based on your biblical study of what Jesus has been doing at this time, or just on the last three installments of this podcast, what do you think the question he asked is going to be? What could he want to hear from Jesus at this point of the mission? I heard Tim Mackey say on his teaching on this topic, maybe John would ask Jesus, "How can I pray for you?" or something else along those lines, might say in today's setting. How's your heart? How's your walk going, Jesus? Give me your highs and lows of the day. That is not what is on John's mind. He has yet another very human reaction to his current circumstances that I wanted to sit on for a bit. John asks, Are you the one? Are you it, Jesus? Are you the Messiah, or shall we look for another? Look, Jesus, it's okay, man. It's cool if you're not. No hard feelings, but I gotta know. Are you it? Wow. Who saw that one coming? Who saw that question coming? Here is John getting reports of what Jesus is going out in the world, and he doesn't think to himself, excellent, excellent. It's all going according to plan. Finally, now we get to go. Now the kingdom's coming. I love it. No, no, that's not what he's saying. He starts questioning what Jesus is doing. He's not convinced. How is that possible at this point? What a human response. Jesus had it in his head. No, John had it in his head. What the kingdom coming was going to look like. He built it up on the inside. I do this all the time. So do you. I will have a thought in the morning of what I think my day is going to look like, and it's going to be great. You know, then I get bumped by life. Email comes through. Interview went weird. Sales proposal didn't land. My wife is mad at me for some reason. I need to figure out. The kids are crying. Sheesh, guys, I thought this was going to be a great day. Then I question everything. I question things that don't even need to be questioned. I assume it's all over. Now, that's a very stupid, poor example of human feelings. Maybe how John might be feeling. Was this all for nothing? This isn't shaking out as planned. What have I done with my life? You know what I'm saying? What did I miss? Did Jesus trick me? Did I back the wrong horse? So John's not getting out of jail. He hears these stories of Jesus going all around doing good. Did he forget me? Do you ever think God forgot about you when something didn't go as planned? Turn the knife. You ever go into something with the best intentions of the world, Christ-like intentions, intending to take on this world?
We're going to show this world a thing or two,
Chris Farley says. And then nothing works. The skies don't open for me. God doesn't pat me on my pretty little head and say, well done, good and faithful servant. You might get mocked or teased, or hell, you might get locked up like John. So right in the middle of the story of God's rescue plan for humans, we have two of the most pivotal figures on stage in John and Jesus. And once again, Jesus isn't doing what anyone thought he would be doing. And he keeps that going until the very end, doesn't he? Andy Stanley always says this on Easter, which I love. Nobody was expecting nobody. Dead people stay dead. A dead Messiah is the end of the road, not this guy. And let's do the spy trick here with John and look at it from his perspective versus us reading the story. John has placed his entire life works into this guy, making the path straight, being the voice in the wild. He hands the baton to Jesus to bring it on home for the big win. And it's not that he's lost hope in the plan. It's just like I said earlier, he had a concept of what this was going to look like. Even if he didn't say it, he is a human. He likes dopamine filling his brain like all of us. As Huberman said in his podcast, dopamine loves anticipation, build up, expectations. So John just got caught up in the circumstances. He's not seeing the full picture. He had the movie script written in his head, and you know, there's another rewrite coming. He's left wondering, just like all of us, when life hits us in the mouth. And if you have ever had your freedom taken away, like John has, man, when those bars slam home, it's got to be the most defeating feeling in the world. Even if you're 100% guilty, it's still a sobering emotion. And that is where we are in this tale. How does Jesus answer his cousin John? Masterfully, of course. He's not upset. He's not angry at John, I don't think. He shows his work, like an elementary school math requirement. Jesus gets word from John's crew that John has a question for him, and they lay it out to Jesus. Jesus tells them, go back to John. Go and report to John what you hear and what you see. The blind are receiving their sight. Oh, and the lame are walking, and the lepers are cleansed by healing, and the deaf are hearing, and the dead are raised, and the poor, they've got the good news being preached to them, guys. All of that is from Isaiah chapter 35, 6, and 31. Oh, and one more thing, John. Blessed, joyful, favored by God, the good life is he who does not take offense at me, accepting me as the Messiah and trusting confidently in my message of salvation, end quote. Whew. In other words, John, it's working, man. Thank you for your help. We are bringing it home. I'm sorry I couldn't tell you how it would play out, but make no mistake, this is all going exactly how it is supposed to go. I just need you to hold on a little bit longer, brother. I know you can't see it now, but all this is going to be worth it. There will be books and devotions and films and plays about our work. people will sit in circles all around the world and discuss what is happening right now. Some idiot in Georgia is even going to do a podcast about it. How many times have you gone to God with something? It might have seemed like the most important thing in the world to you. You beg God, take the pain away. Make time stop. Make time go backwards so you can change that horrible, stupid thing you said. Ask for a family or a friend to not die or ever get hurt again. It never plays out the way you think it would. And that is the story that we are shown here, and it comes from two pillars of my faith, and they are having the same back and forth that I have sitting in silence in my home office, trying to see things how God sees them and be ready to move when he calls me, especially when I can't see it. That's when you grow. And learning to trust the plan even to death is how we change the world. What a dialogue. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, how's the story of John end here? How the greatest man that ever lived pre-cross wrap up his time on the Monopoly board? Not so good, as it turns out. If you haven't heard the story already, it's not fun. You know how you hear people question if there is a God or not because bad things happen on earth, and that shows a loving God would not allow such pain? Or why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? You can put this story right at the top of that list. You'll see what I mean in a minute. All right, so again, John's in prison. Herod the Great, from the previous episodes, that's the one who killed all the young boys, met with the Magi, killed all the young boys under 2 years old when he heard about Jesus' birth. Yeah, that guy. Horrible, horrible, horrible evil man. Well, he had some kids, and the apple doesn't far too fall from the tree. This son's name is Antipas, but he took on the name Herod to be like his dad. So when you see Herod Antipas, that's the new king. King's a strong word here, by the way. Rome is ruling. They almost threw this crew a bone, mainly for the spice wealth, remember that? But they don't have any power. They're a puppet king to make the Jewish people think they had their own little, you know, little government in this little town. They do not. Remember, the joke is that Herod and his sons, they're not even Jewish. They're Idumean. They're descendants of Edom, which is, you know, the hairy red son, Esau. Remember Jacob and Esau? I can't get into that right now, but yeah. Okay, so this Herod has a wife, but here's the rub. This wife was previously the wife of Herod Antipas's brother, who was named Herod II. And that original couple, they had a daughter named Salome, who became the stepdaughter of her uncle through this. Still with me? So we got a divorce, an in-family marriage, and what will start to look like a lust situation with this beautiful niece Salome. We're not given much detail on how or when John the Baptist confronts this situation, but it said that he did. The voice crying in the wilderness in some way or another let that king know that this marriage is not right. It's an abomination. It's against all the statutes of what marriage should be. This puppet king and his new wife, and old wife for that matter, are, you know, they're not pleased with this superstar preacher guy. It's embarrassing. It fires them up, but Herod knows John is locked in with the Jewish God, and he knows what that guy can do, so he respects him. I would say he fears him. But he can't let anyone know that. It'll make him appear weak. A king can't look afraid of a prophet of this, you know, wilderness king. So what happens? Herod Antipas throws a drunken rager birthday bash for himself. He invites all the exclusive high-end wealth, royalty, celebs, all to celebrate how awesome he is. Very, very, you know, kingly political thing to do, you know? Herod calls for his stepdaughter, Salome, to come out and dance for the crowd. Let me tell you guys, this is not innocent. She's not a ballerina, okay? This isn't a tasteful, beautiful dance for entertainment where we're like, oh, isn't that cute? It's the opposite. It's exactly what you're thinking. This is a seductive dance that is probably scantily clad. This is a different time. I would gauge that she's a teenager, and that would be putting it modestly. She fuels the crowd with her erotic dance, and as a show of power, Herod makes a drunken, lustful, crucial mistake in front of his peers. The king is so pleased with this dance. That's in the scripture. The king is so pleased with this dance, take that how you will, that he makes a drunken invitation to give her a gift. He issues a vow in his swirling, wine-fueled mind to the crowd on his oath, the king's oath. He will give her whatever she wants. She doesn't even have the scope of reference for what he's at. This is a crazy scene, man. So she goes to mom. She goes to the mother. Remember, this mother's, you know, none too pleased with John the Baptist because recently he openly exclaimed that her marriage and relationship with this king is not good in the eyes of Yahweh. So what does mom tell the daughter to do? She says, tell him to give you John the Baptist's head on a dinner platter. And when getting this news, man, the king is distressed. He's like, oh, dang it. Why did I say that? Why didn't I keep my big mouth shut? Everyone in here is looking at me now. I can't flake on this. I got to do it. I'll lose my pride. I'll lose my honor. And so he does. He tells the guards to go and cut John the Baptist's head off and then bring it to him. And they do it. His bloody head is brought into the party on a platter and given to this teenage girl. The girl brings the carcass across the royal ballroom to mom and the king. This is in the Bible, folks. You should read the Bible. This is what worldly kingdoms look like. And this is history, but look at today. Look at all the conflicts around the earth. And, you know, some are done in the name of good, right? Like we're protecting our borders or in the name of a country. We need to kill these people or they're going to kill us back. That's empire. That's the empire way, and kings rule empires. And if we have to bomb a wedding or two in another country on accident because we have the wrong coordinates, so be it, man. Most wars are wars of attrition. Collateral damage will happen. Nothing new under the sun. Right, Solomon? It's always about land and power, sex and money. So our protagonist, our partner and colleague of Jesus, dies a horrible, sad, painful death at the request of a teenage seductive dance that got the elite so excited that they offered her any request up to half the entire kingdom. That is what happened. Another unfair, unjust reality of this world that we are in. And you can see how people can turn from faith when they get hit with examples like this in their own life. But one thing to keep in mind that I have said before, the basis of the Christian faith stands on the fact that the worst thing in the world happened to the most perfect, sinless human being that ever lived. That is the foundation of the faith. So whoever told you that life gets easier as soon as Jesus comes into your life could potentially have done you a disservice and set you up for disappointment. And I am sorry for that. It happens to all of us. It's not that when you make Jesus your cornerstone that all your problems wash away. There is a war on for your mind and your soul. It is learning to see this world how Jesus sees it. And he doesn't grade on a curve. So don't get all Christian American high horse when you see a senseless murder occur on the news or adultery in your neighborhood or someone cheating another to get a better lot in life. Jesus taught on this and ramped up the status of how he wants us to act. He is the judge, not us. Take the plank out of your own eye before worrying about the splinter in your neighbor's eye. Yeah, you didn't murder anybody, but when you hate, when you've got old hate sitting in your heart for someone, you know exactly what I'm talking about right now when I say it. When you have that old hate in your heart and you can't forgive that person, Jesus is saying that also leads to death. You didn't commit adultery, but you did look at some chicks on Instagram and look up your old girlfriend on Facebook. That also leads to death. Do you guys see what I'm saying? It is a slippery slope. So don't even let yourself get comfortable with seeing sin like that. We are all lost. We all have thoughts like Herod. We might just not have the resources and power to do what he did. But plenty of us have made drunken decisions that cost us more than we care to admit. Think of your teenage years. Think of your 20s. Remember that time? Yeah, I remember that time too. And I'm glad I survived it. When I definitely could have died or, God forbid worse, killed someone else. We are no different. And the beauty of Jesus is how he takes the broken people like you and I. He takes our broken circumstances in life and he breaks it over himself. He holds on to it. He holds on to our hearts. He prays for it. He aches for us and he blesses it. And then it becomes a gift to others, even to the point of his own death, letting it break him to give us a chance at Eden. Never forget what has been done for you, as I try not to as well. And what does Jesus do when he hears the news of his beloved cousin? John the Baptist gets his head cut off. They go to Jesus and they tell him. And when Jesus heard this about John, he left there privately in a boat and went to a secluded place. But when the crowds heard of this, they followed him on foot from the cities. End quote. Man, I love this. Does Jesus know the end game? Does he know that in a very, very short time, he will also be back in the kingdom of the skies? He can hug John when he gets there and celebrate their hard work for eternity together. Yeah, there was a death, but everyone dies. And people like John the Baptist, I would imagine, is at the head of the line to get to paradise and rejoice forever. We all think that. I hope to see him. And yet Jesus still goes off to a quiet place to process this. His cousin is dead. He feels the feelings. He is sad, just like he does when Lazarus dies. That's another relative of his. He cries then as well. On his way to bring him back to life, he stops and cries. You guys see that? This helps me so much. I lost my mom in 2020 to ovarian cancer myself. It was horrible, still is. Anyone who's lost a parent will tell you the same. It's just a different life now. But with everyone involved in that scenario being so sad and not able to cope, I took it upon myself to be the strong one. I needed to be strong and have a bold face to show my children and my family that we are okay. I'm okay. We will press on. And I will tell you, brother, that stance cost me. It cost my mental health, my behaviors, my relationships. And that's because I didn't sit in it long enough. The Jewish people are very good at this. And Jesus shows us here, they mourn. And they don't move on until they have fully processed that grief. That's the only way forward. Not a fake smile that everyone can see through. Be sad. Feel terrible. Feel the hurt. Because the good life is for those who mourn. As Jesus also told us on the Sermon on the Mount. It's okay to miss those that are close to you. Jesus models this. And he was about to be with John literally in a very short period of time. And he goes off alone to wrap his brain around the loss of his brother in the movement. That teaches me so much, and I am thankful for stories like this and so much more. The funny thing is the crowds, they got no time for this, man. They got to be healed, Jack. Yo, Jesus, I know you're bummed out, but I got this skin disease. If you want to take care of that real quick, thank you, sir. Can you touch my skin, and then I'll leave you alone. And here also is where Jesus shows us what love is. He can't help himself. He is such an overflowing vessel of pure love that the story ends and goes right into the feeding of the 5,000. I mean, you guys should read the Bible. All right, let's see if it was all worth it. Jesus is gone. He's ascended to the right hand of God to be at his rightful spot on the throne, having conquered sin and death. He sent the Holy Spirit to his apostles to help them as they go to the ends of the earth, telling everyone what Jesus did and taught them. We're in Acts 2 here. And Peter is addressing the crowds after they have seen the boldness of these disciples in their preaching and teachings. Remember how many times Peter messed up? Now watch Peter. The same guy that ran away when Jesus was racked up there on that tree. Again, they all fled. No one rushed up the hill to rip Jesus, the rabbi, off that cross, right? I didn't read that. They would have surely died, and they're watching their teacher be killed, and the movement is over. It's getting destroyed before their eyes. Now we have Peter talking to the crowds. I'm not going to read the speech. You got to read it yourself. It's right up there with Stephen's speech. Another banger. These disciples are preaching to the crowds filled with the Holy Spirit. They are speaking in one language, and yet everyone in the crowd from all over the Mediterranean rim can understand them. That's like if I'm speaking English right now, and everyone listening who speaks Mandarin, Spanish, German, Swahili, they can all understand me perfectly. That's what was happening. Some even thought they were drunk. It's so weird. You know, maybe they're just in a blackout. His basic message to the crowds was this, is that Jesus was exactly who he was claiming to be the entire time. All the patriarchs, all the prophets, all the Psalms, King David, Abraham, everyone was waiting and wanting the Savior, warrior, priest, king, and they got him here and everyone missed it. Hell, they didn't miss it. You guys killed the author of life. The creator's partner in creation? Yeah, you guys hung him on a tree and killed the greatest thing that has ever happened in this earth. We're all witnesses to it. We saw the risen Christ. We saw the holes in his hands. We had breakfast with the dude on the beach. That's what has just happened. And it says that the crowd says they were, quote, cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, brothers, what can we do? What should we do? What do we do? You know what Peter said? Peter said, what you need to do is attend church regularly and make sure and follow these rules. Just kidding. He did not say that. Of course he didn't say that. He said what our hero John the Baptist has been screaming from the mud. Peter said, repent and be baptized. Here's what you do, guys. It's not too late. It's never too late. But it is time now. Time to change. Change your mind. Change your brain. Change your posture and position in this life and make Jesus king of that life. This isn't about a what. It's about a who. And these people traveled here because they're trying. They paid money to get here. They aren't worshiping the other gods. But the way of the temple, that temple model, that's over. Forgiveness is no longer found in a building and an earthly mediator in the form of a priest. It's not found in a sacrifice or an animal or a spice or incense. It's a new kingdom. It now resides in Jesus. Why? Because he just paid for all the sins of the world, man. He slayed the dragon. He let himself get separated from his perfect Father to absorb death onto himself and defeat it, to give us peace. And biblical peace is not the absence of conflict. It's the presence of harmony. Did you notice much earthly peace around Jesus or John? No, but they're in harmony with the long game. King Jesus made things new, and he started with our hearts, followed by our minds and our spirit. And he asks us to go get others and teach them what he taught us, how to view our relationships, our money, our stress, our prayer life, our rest, our communities, our political leaders, our enemies, and our family, and that he will be with us the entire time to guide and correct us and love on us. Now go, multiply, multiply, multiply. I am Tyler Parker. Sunday School is out.